Before I get into what I'm going to say today, I'd like to make several notes of some books. I mentioned yesterday that it wouldn't hurt to read a biography on Christopher Dock. That's what the book looks like. Matthew mentioned this book. If you have trouble finding yourself in the stream of history and seeing how your life and teaching finds its place right here. Okay? You really, every Christian school teacher, it's not bedtime reading so much. I'll just be fair with you. But I would encourage this book. The other book that I talked about and that I emphasized and said that I followed this model and some of his ideas is A History of Christian School Education by Paul Keenel, 2-volume series. Quite expensive, but a good investment. 10 years of research and work to put this together, and that matters. A lot of trips to Europe and etc. What makes this different from some of the others is it's more readable. It is considered a college textbook in how it was written, but it is much more readable than some, and it also is a history of Christian school education, not Christian education, which is larger. All right. So if you are wanting a resource to study and develop some ideas from, feel free to purchase those books. We begin our final session together with maybe a few comments of clarification from yesterday that I'd like to just note, especially regarding public education. I want to say several things about public education. One is that public schools ought not to be put in one particular box. There are vast differences in schools. There really are. So I want to be careful that I don't malign something unfairly. Secondly, have you considered what might happen if we did not have public education right now? I know it's secular and humanistic, but have you considered? In many ways, thin as the fabric may be, it is a very important part of the social fabric right now that is holding a whole lot together. I'm not commenting about what it is. I'm saying that it is an important part right now, holding things together. Such is the power of education, of course. In other words, there is a place for it. And I'm not arguing that there should not be a change. I'm simply saying that they have a place. There are Christian teachers in public education, and they make a difference. And so I have no intention with my comments yesterday to pit us against the public system. I do not want us to see ourselves in antithesis to them. It's an us and them. I don't think that's helpful. That simply ends up breeding reaction. I would rather us look forward to what we want. Besides, we wrestle not against flesh and blood and public schools, but against principalities and powers. That's very different. Yesterday, we thought about the era of time from 1600 to about 1970. We traced some movement in the colonial education enterprise, the rise of the public school, the loss of the common school, private school, to a public free education. We saw Mennonites very, very comfortable with local public schools as they experienced them for about 100 years, from 1850 to 1950. We also noticed the rising fear of the implications of this kind of education. We also noticed that the Industrial Revolution was not kind to our communities, our way of life, and education. The Mennonites began to be very concerned and aware of what was happening in the schools. Now, in my comments today, I want to say several things in the beginning. I am grateful for all of the young teachers in this crowd. I'll be grateful if you teach for 30, 40 years. I'm especially gratified to see a very good representation of men. May you teach for 50 years. And I'm very gratified that a board member came for the week from Tennessee. I also want to recognize that we have a very broad spectrum sitting here today of ages, experience, denomination, views of the way things are. So what I have to say today is not intended to point any fingers. It's not in my place to pass judgment. And so I want to speak humbly as one of us today. I do speak out of genuine concern and heart. And I speak from the perspective of a vision for our churches, much more deeply than a vision for our schools. My perspective is certainly not faultless. I have observed some things. This week, Mark, one of the attendees here, said, "How are you, girl?" And I, he asked, "What do you know?" And I said, "A lot less than I used to." And that's what it feels like this morning. So I'd ask you to open your ears and your heart. Today does not feel as put together for a number of reasons. But among them is I have so many swirling thoughts and concerns and maybe just heart for what I see. And so I thank you in advance for giving me grace and space today. I went to public school when I grew up. My first 8 years were in public school. It was one of these rural schools in which there was 100 students in our school, and the principal was from our church. Does it remind you of some story yesterday? Principal's from our church, and about three of the staff, when I first came into the school, were from the Mennonite church in the area. Okay, and so I grew up in this, however. And I had a good experience, really I did. We didn't say the flag salute every morning. We prayed before meals and we prayed in the morning. And we did things. So, well, we had Christian teachers. And we had a principal who certainly didn't push the flag salute. So my experiences may be different than what some people's were. However, it didn't mean that I had teachers that were perfect. Or maybe even understood children all that well. Many, many stories of mine come from third and fourth grade. This is Mrs. Wilt. She made a third and fourth grader wilt. She really did. Because, you know, her vision was not for the students. It was to make her life as simple as possible. And so she employed various and sundry interesting techniques and ways of disciplining us to make our life simple, such as when you forgot to put your name on the paper, she'd say, "I'm going to prick your finger and make you write your name with blood 10 times. And a third and fourth grader wonders, "What, would she do that?" And we actually thought probably she would. By the way, we put our names on our paper too. Very effective, I will say that. And when you, if you were lining up for lunch or recess, she would look down through the line. If somebody was doing a little something out of line, she would come by with her 10-foot fingernails and tap you on the head, and you just would wilt. That's just how it was. And there was a lot of fear in third and fourth grade. But then I had Miss Croker, and probably I was her teacher's pet, if truth be told. But I really did enjoy school. It's just I was a mess in third and fourth grade. I was. I was not the angelic one. I'm not proud of it. But then I had Miss Croker, and she turned something on, a switch in me that made me come alive. And then Coach, seventh and eighth grade, finished me off. And much of who I am today is because of a seventh and eighth grade teacher. That's why I'm in education. one teacher. Well, it wasn't just one. It was first and second grade Mrs. Morris, who loved her children and had a vision. I know she had a vision. What, she's still living, and I go back sometimes and I can talk to her. And she cares about me yet today. Yes, our schools have significant impact on who we are. And so my experience, I'm sure, is different in our community than in Kansas. Did start a school. We started a high school already in 1975, but then it was about early 90s when we started our own grade school, or a 1-8 school. You know, through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, particularly through the 60s, we found ourselves in a whirlwind of the cultural movement and morass of the 60s. The kind of living and thinking that the sexual revolution brought was astonishing to our conservative congregations. It was now a felt reality. Our public schools were not serving the church, and we were very concerned. Now, at the same time, much was happening in the Mennonite church. We're moving from agrarianism, from farming, to specialized vocations more and more. And we were adopting significant technology, primarily in the business world. And so things are afoot in the Mennonite church. And hundreds of schools began in the 70s. Now, I think we began our schools not so much with the vision for what we wanted our church to be in 50 years, as it was to escape the tragedy we saw unfold in the public system. Now, I will quickly concede that that is not completely accurate, in that our people cared about the rising generation and were motivated to tremendous sacrifice. However, the thinking about the current culture, along with a deep, abiding vision for what we wanted our children to become, was absent in far too many cases. We often had one or two visionary people in church who helped get the church started, the school started. But it didn't have that long-term look. One way I know that is because we immediately adopted basically the public system in our schools. Same curriculum. Same approaches, different teachers, different building. I'm speaking in broad strokes here. We didn't have competitive sports and proms and as much immodesty, but we knew we needed to move quickly, and we did. Now, I want understood that I affirm the opening of our Christian day schools, absolutely. However, I'm going to come back to this after a while. It's not a sustained vision. Now, in these glory years of starting schools, you have Christian Light publication started, 1969 to 1972. You have Sanford Schenck, who wanted wholesome literature in the homes. And by 78, CLE was formed, and by 1980, the revised Alpha Omega publications were put out there for people. There were many hiccups, inaccuracies in this curriculum, and CLE will tell you very clearly, without any problem, that they're not all that proud of that first edition. Okay, it had issues. But it did give them a place to start from. And since then, of course, the Sunrise edition brought significant changes, and this is a huge enterprise of what CLE is doing today. And many things have improved in this enormous project of publishing curriculum. And of course, Rod and Staff and Pathway are players in that scene as well, with their significant concern that the textbooks, the things that our students used, did not promote Anabaptist values and beliefs. In 1970, another thing happened. Dr. Donald Howard started Accelerated Christian Education, ACE. And this was a fundamental shift in how our school saw education. You see, what it ended up really doing is saying that the facilitator, the monitor was there to help along, but at some levels it replaced the teacher. What it meant is that any of us who were 16 to 18 and could do crowd control could teach school. Now, I've taught individualized. I really am not. There is a place in our small schools. We have to be creative. It has given us options. Do you understand what I'm saying? It pulled the necessity of the teacher away at some level. I talk with a person here who has 8 grades this year, 1 teacher, and it's seen as the teacher is the pivotal point, even in that setting. Something happened there. By 1982, Basic Christian Education, BCE, was started by Abe Swartz to promote Christian education. And he had early visions of making this patriotic curriculum palatable for our people. Now, these revisions actually never happened, but it was the underlying vision. In 07, Abe retired, and the business moved to Ohio. Of course, CLE saw the need more recently then in curriculum to say, we need to provide conventional textbooks. And so now they're producing both. Well, now we have a lot of curriculum to choose from Protestants, from Anabaptists, from the secular world. There's lots out there. And we've been going for 30, 40 years. And our schools have grown up. We've matured. We now have the second, third, and even in some cases the fourth generation rising. But the questions I now field here in what I do when I have schools calling me is not how shall I start, help me think about how to start a Christian school. It's how can we keep our doors open? Something has changed. Well, now I'd like to step back, way back again, and I'd like for us to think together about what will history teach us here. The last 3 days, we've taken a 2,500-year trip, and I'd like to pull from that and make sure we've made some connections. We are not persecuted today. This is very unusual in the history of the Western world. However, historically, we saw that that leads to apathy very quickly. We note that wherever the church was very much on fire for the Lord and had a deep vision for the church cared about education. Now, I want to make a distinction here. Education is everything that churches and parents and schools do to train and develop and grow their children. Schooling is a part of education, but it's not the whole story. Education is about developing a whole person, and a school will certainly contribute to the education, but it is indeed not the school's responsibility to do the education. It is a component in which school is a part of something larger. Historically, whenever the church was doing well, the church was a key player in figuring out what kind of schooling should happen as part of education. While schools changed approaches as necessary, Christian schools have been around for thousands of years, literally. Schools rose and fell on the backs of church. And they rose and fell, more specifically, on the people involved. We notice throughout the stream of history that people's ideas had consequences. The culture, the church, and the school was dependent on people. And God is not up here somewhere orchestrating all of these things and making people make this decision, that decision. No. People made choices in thought and lifestyle and belief, and it had consequence. We are not puppets of a sovereign God. He actually gives us choice. And these choices have significant ramifications. We notice, too, that movements in culture had significant consequences in the church. Did you catch what I said? Movements in culture had significant consequences in the church. Even to those who we would say are non-conformed. You will be touched by the culture. Yes, in the world, but not of it. If you've taught more than 10 years, you know that students have changed dramatically. We're touched by the culture. That's how it's always been. I've tried to show you throughout the week that intentionally, and sometimes unintentionally, of course, cultures had intentional plans to reproduce and keep reproducing their view of what culture should look like. Athens and Sparta had very different models, but both were incredibly successful over the centuries. These ideas were so powerful that how you and I think about education today has been indelibly shaped by these ideas and by the people it produced. Education consists of more than learning to read. It concerns itself about the means a people or a culture use to transmit its values, beliefs, and lifestyles. And finally, Christian education and schooling placed a high value on Scripture and absolute truth. And now I dive into a more current analysis of the issues we face today. And then we'll end with not a recipe and a formula, but a few ideas for us to think about as we go from here. Our Anabaptist schools are in crisis, and they don't know it. And frankly, I'm not sure what to do about it either, okay? I just know we're at a critical crossroads in our Christian schools. And I think we have seen that if we can kind of keep going and things sort of, you know, we have a little bit of pay and the building stays there and there's curriculum there and a few pencils and some materials, why, we have school! So what is creating the crisis for the Christian school? One component of education. One of those crises that is increasing is the acceptance, and I'm going to be treading probably on some dangerous territory here. I asked for grace and space before, and maybe I need to ask for it again as I launch into this. There's an acceptance, an increased availability of alternative methods of education. For a long time, we simply saw schools sort of map from public system. What does this look like? Well, we now have online public charter schools. In Pennsylvania, I have lost well over 15 students in this school to online school. Secondly, an alternative has been homeschooling. I'm not philosophically opposed to homeschooling, period. Understand me. If the church together decides that is a legitimate and appropriate way for that church with its vision for its children to educate its children, I'm all for it. However, I think it's contributed to a more individual approach to church life. Not in all cases. I'm making broad statements. If the shoe fits, wear it. But it has become where dad makes the choice. Fathers have become the priests. In the New Testament, the family is at the heart of the church, absolutely. In the New Testament, I see the church as core. That's a shift. I believe Deuteronomy 6. I do. I also believe in the church. And so with the availability of the materials, the availability and the welcoming open arms in some groups, what we ended up having is people doing it all kinds of ways. And so sometimes homeschooling has not done real well, and then in the community neither has the school. And it's sort of a mixed mess almost. Number two, we face some church dynamics. Schools have become disconnected from the church. We hear it about the school is an arm of the church. But how does it function as an arm of your church? I'm coming to the conclusion that we do more lip service to the idea of being an arm of the church than it really being an integral part of our young people's experience in education. The school has become disconnected from the church, and historically, that is always a problem. There's other church dynamics. We no longer have the same level of commitment to brotherhood. Rather, we've given a nod to community, which has been stripped of its good qualities in the last number of years. What it means is a loose coalition of people hoping to get along, rather than brotherhood. And it's impacted education that we just all make the decision we want for our families. The churches who have decided how they will do education are far ahead today. The commitment within brotherhood to say, what do we want for our children? What do we want for the church in 50 and 500 years? And how will we train our children in a way that will get us there? And then come under each other in that. There's another church dynamic. We have significant movement between churches. Sometimes you hear it talked about as church hopping. That's affecting education. There's a loss of ability to deeply sacrifice for each other. And for our children when it comes to education. After all, the one-week cruise to the Caribbean could be put in jeopardy by school. Mr. Miller, I was wondering if I could... We've always, before we were coming to school, gone to this cabin. You've been there, some of you? No longer are we willing to sacrifice, give up in the same way. Pleasure is incredibly important to us. Maybe it's the new God, a very old new God. Another church dynamic is significant wealth creation of the last 30 years. And it's a blessing, but with it is a painful reality of what too much money can do. Of what it means, how we look at our children. And finally, another church dynamic is the family is in crisis. Parents do not see the first 7 years of a child's life as part of education. Didn't that historically? It's a huge problem. The family is in crisis. And there's various reasons for this. There are more separated couples among us. Divorce is becoming increasingly an option. With the tragedy of children sitting in front of multimedia, we've even rewired our brains. Literally. There's increased learning disabilities. That will not go away, folks. That will only increase. Jonas told me last week that every 17 minutes an autistic child is born. Indeed, we have become rewired. It's putting the family in crisis. The economy, the third issue. That's just simply affordability of Christian schools. School education has never been cheap. It just isn't. And you know why it's not? It involves people. As we move into some uncharted territory in the next 15 years in this country, yesterday the headline said that stock market now has a negative gain for the year, and we're supposed to be coming out of our recession. We're supposed to be increasing our wealth, and it's not happening. The economy is going to have to be reckoned with. Fourthly, the implications of technology. I talked about that already in terms of alternatives to education. The online school has become an option. And it's not that I'm opposed to not using online education or that we cannot utilize DVDs. I will admit to being intrigued by having a homeschool, for instance, or a school, and there's both of these where you sit everybody in front of the video screen and leave them there for 4 to 5 hours while they're taught. Really? I think that's a tragedy. Technology has given us that possibility. The implications of technology are wide and they are deep. It has changed our view of knowledge. It has become facts versus living truth. It's a Google and Wikipedia approach to knowledge, to truth. Facts are king, and relationship with teacher is optional. Knowing has become a god, while wisdom has been sidelined. After all, what we need to know can be downloaded. Information and data is king, and we are drowning in information and gasping without knowing it for a relationship. Social networking. Who are you? Who I know you to be in the classroom as a student, or who you are on Facebook? And do you really listen to that music and watch those movies? And if so, who are you? Who I see and talk to, or what I see? Two lives. That has created social networking. We are now global. We're not local. How do I know this? Because now we have trouble sitting with each other without yanking our cell phones out. My brother-in-law took a young person in the youth group on a trip to Cabela's. Most young men would appreciate if a 30-year-old man, young married man, would take 17-year-old, it was two of them, to Cabela's. 2-hour trip. And halfway through that trip, he was irate and finally said, "Are you going to join me on this trip or not?" What was he doing? Texting. He hit a record of 8,000 in 1 month. This young man did. Folks, he was with, but not with. And even if you don't have an addiction to texting and social networking, it's affecting you. We are hardly present with each other. We coexist peacefully. Life isn't nearly as messy this way. So cell phones, we're so connected now. Oh, my 14-year-old has to have a cell phone. What if something happened? Yeah, that's what I'm for. It's my job. I'll take care of it. I'm astonished. I'm astonished. In a report yesterday about Britain, and I don't think this country is too far away from that. This is more recent than what I had before. There was a report that showed the influence that communications technology has on our daily lives and on the way we behave and communicate with each other. Our research, this firm said, into the use of smartphones in particular reveals how quickly people become reliant on new technology to the point of feeling addicted. Shock. As more and more people acquire cell phones, they are becoming an essential tool in people's social lives, whether they are out with friends socializing or using Facebook on the move. Unsurprisingly, multitasking teenagers said they were less likely to read books if they owned a smartphone. The huge boost in smartphone sales in Britain has led to a 67% increase in mobile data use as phone users watched videos and sent emails on the go. ...47% of British teenagers and 20% of adults use a smartphone, own a smartphone. And 60% of adults and 37% of smartphone owners describe themselves as highly addicted to their device. On the average, these same people spend around 50 hours on the internet or in a month, equivalent to 1 hour and 40 minutes a day. This is in addition to 4 hours of TV a day. Technology an issue? Oh, no, not for us. We don't have TV. I see. It's become more than just a distraction. It's become a way we think. Technology is a much bigger beast than we have reckoned with, I think. It has been extremely useful. I'm grateful for all the technology. Yes, full disclosure, I have a smartphone. It is a wonderful tool. Email and calendar, the two things for me. I get 50 to 60 emails a day, and to keep up with some of that, it's very helpful. Sometimes I wonder. Look, it's like this. It has changed how we see relationships. It's an elephant in the room that we're hardly willing to identify and say it is what it is. Oh, all I have is a cell phone. What people aren't saying is that they're accessing the internet. There's a whole bunch of behind the backs of the churches and parents and families with little devices. I know of a student, I heard of a student who had the ability to text friends in the classroom with a cell phone without taking it out of his pocket. It's beyond me how you would do that, but I guess it's possible. You see, it's become a way of life. It's instead of a tool, it's almost become us. It's a part of our fabric, and it has created a whole host of things we must consider. One of the most tragic parts of this, I think, is that accountability is to a nebulous group in a virtual cloud rather than my church brothers and sisters. It has hit at the heart of who we are as Anabaptists. The fifth issue we must confront and understand is postmodernism. And this, of course, is a reaction to modernism, and we're not going to go into all of that today. The idea that truth is relative. The increasing gap between saying and doing. I have discussions now with my students who will agree with me on a certain point, and that night, without feeling anything inside, do the exact opposite. And trust me, it's not just your students, it's you feel less of an integrity issue as a whole than we did 20 years ago. There's an increasing gap between saying and doing. The other thing it's given us is compliance, but not respect, a passive respect. It's been a significant breakdown of authority, and we have to reckon with what that's done for us. You see, there's a big difference between compliance and respect. I think Peter's been talking about that. It's not just about doing, yeah, I'll do that. And they don't fight us in the same way. They're very kind about it. We have to reckon with that. We have to reckon with the fact that young people, and this includes you if you are a young person, and even if you're not so young anymore, you think differently. You speak a different language in a lot of ways. The rising generation is looking for realness. They're looking for struggle in older people, not pat answers. In fact, they won't take pat answers. They don't want a formula or a recipe. What they want is to see you struggle and have conversation about that. They want to be a part of the conversation, not have things handed to them. They desire challenge and risk. Why do you think extreme sports has taken off? Why do you think there are teams going into countries where they need to smuggle Bibles in? We do this, right? Young people want something bigger. And we have got to get that figured out. They need a place. I think they need a place to see us struggle. They need a place to be a part of a conversation. And one of our challenges is figuring out how to do that well. The shifts in our culture are cataclysmic. And postmodernism and technology have been two things that have created this crisis. The shifts in the way our people think are so great we can hardly get our mind around it. The level of progress is so fast and so vertical, we really can't see ahead very far. Yesterday, another article, "The Future of Education, Robots Teach Toddlers." Robots could one day help teach kids in classrooms, suggests research involving droids, robots, and toddlers in California. A robot named Ruby has already shown that it can significantly improve how well infants learn words, and the latest version of the bot under development should also be able to wheel around classrooms, too. Isn't that neat? A moving robot for our children. I thought, let's bring robots to the child care center. And the children got really scared. It was really a horrible experience, the inventor recalled. But it showed that the robots really got their attention. That if we got the experience right, it could be potentially very powerful at evoking the emotional responses we'd want. The kids naturally had to want to interact with Ruby. And the best learning was seen when children spent 4 or more uninterrupted minutes with the robot. We found that subtle changes in the parameters of timing, such as motions of Ruby's head, had huge effects on the interactions we observed between children and the robot. When the researchers got the timing right, making it seem alive, the children followed where Ruby's gaze went and eagerly pointed in those directions. Every time the kids did something right, Ruby would say, "Excellent," and the kids would be happy, rewarding themselves by saying "Excellent" throughout the classroom. Also, by learning about social interactions from a computational point of view, we can learn how to enable computers to interact with humans the way we interact with each other. These are some of the most advanced technologies in learning out there right now. Folks, it's cataclysmic change. It is. There's something big going on. I don't know what else to say about that. It's a big deal. And finally, number 7 is the issue of vision. We have a problem of purpose. An identity crisis, if you will. Who are we? What are we doing? And why are we doing it? What will keep the Christian schools moving the right direction is not the program or activities, but its vision carried on by its people. Too many of our schools do not have a clear sense of mission. Why are we doing school? Do you know the mission statement of your school? Do you have one? And if you do, is it current? I've said before that many of our schools have been weakened considerably because what shaped the school was to provide an alternative to a godless, evolutionary, depraved setting. While this is notable, defining what we are by what we are not will lead us to a crisis of identity, and we are there. It is also the crisis of the church today. It's probably helpful to consider that one must do nothing in order for a school to lose its way. You just kind of have school, and that's all it takes. It's very easy, actually. It's not difficult at all. It does not take apostasy. It does not take huge compromise. School can just happen. Vision. How do I know the vision is waning? Attendance numbers keep going down in many schools. Students care less. There's financial struggle. Schools running separately from the church. Many today, really in the back of their mind, think of our Christian schools as a private school, a nicer, cleaner, drug and sex-free version of the local public school. And in our schools, they're going to score higher on the tests and will likely learn a few more things that will help them in business. Oh, and they teach the Bible, which is really nice. Does that ring true with you? Like when you stop and think about, it's so nice we have our own school. No, it's not nice. It's essential. If it was only nice, there wouldn't be a problem. But if we read history right, it is absolutely core. How do I know there's a loss of vision? School is thought about whenever the next board meeting comes around. It's not a living, breathing part of the fabric and tapestry of the church. There's rapid school board changeover. We're not producing students who love to learn, who are curious to learn. We tend toward the idea that, well, we got to do school to satisfy the requirements. It's a necessary evil kind of approach. We must do it. Let's do it pretty good. It's not vision. That's duty. And training and educating children should be all joy. There should be a tremendous amount of energy because when you're off the scene, it's them who are on the scene. It's a lack of school leadership. Sorry, men. Too many times, we're going through the motions, putting out fires, but who is sitting down and saying, in your community, in your school, in your church, saying, what do we want for our children? And how can the school get behind the church? Not lead the church, get behind the church. I think we give lip service to education. We would say we have a vision. And we think we have a vision, and it looks like we do because we have a school, but I'm saying, I wonder. There's little commitment to sustained professional development as teachers and training. I know people who go to DHIA meetings, Dairy Herd Improvement Association meetings. They are trained regularly. They find out the latest and greatest ways to get their cows to produce 5 more pounds of milk. I used to milk cows. And I used to go to the service, the case dealer. Yes, that's fine. It's red. It's good. I used to go to those meetings and learn how to do better with the combine servicing. And my boss sent me there. And he paid me to do it. Even when I was 14, I went to one of those. We are fine doing that. But in our schools, what are we doing to develop the people? We have to reckon with that. I don't think it's sustainable, folks. And I'm not thinking about faith builders right now. You got to come for 2 years. I'm not even talking about that. I remember a man who came to our church, a dear brother of mine now, excuse me. He told me that one of the reasons that he felt the need to come to our church was because the school had completely fallen apart. He said, look, Gerald, this is what happens. I have a jar of molasses here, and here's an empty jar. And this is my 17 and 16-year-old teacher, and they're pouring their life into my child and everything they know. And 2 years after they're out of school, they pour out of their life into these children. What happens when you do that to molasses? We need to understand the dichotomy we have created, the split. And I'm calling us to consider, how will you keep growing as a teacher? You don't have to know it all to start, but how will you keep going? How will you develop? How will you give your students what they need? There's few long-term teachers. We sometimes have more facilitators than teachers. There's poor pay for teachers. There aren't enough men in the classroom. And I bless every woman that's in the classroom. That's not the point, but I think you know what I'm saying. Actually, this crisis of identity and purpose can be used by God to help us find our way. Oh, it's not that bleak, you see. After these 30, 40 years, we need a re-envisioning, a redefinition. And I would call us to the very hard work, the tremendous struggle of understanding who we are and what we want in our schools. What must take place? There's no silver bullet. It's going to look differently in every community. And first of all, I would say what needs to happen is a renewed sense of humility. We need to understand we serve the church. The church does not serve us. I think it's going to take, number one, conversation. Conversation among church leaders. I long for the day in which every time ministers of a church get together, on the agenda is the school. What do you think would happen? You ever thought about that? I think the church leadership and the board needs to be talking. That's more than just a minister attending the board meetings. That's helpful. The church and the school need to have conversations. There needs to be conversation between the generations, from old to young. We have to understand our young people. And frankly, for those of us who are 35, 40, 45, and on up, it's more difficult than what we want to admit to truly understand each other. This conversation needs to include some fundamental principles of Anabaptist education. That it must never be removed or divorced from a teacher. Our reason for educating our children ought to be because it is vital to their capacity to love and serve God and men. Huge. We need to start seeing that we need to emphasize the practices and values of Anabaptism, the things that are us, stories, singing, scripture, and service. In order for this conversation to happen, schools must be willing to become a living, breathing part of the church, to come under the church. And the church must begin to see education as their one of their primary roles in preparing the church for kingdom living. For the Anabaptist schools to reproduce the kind of people we really want, we will need to have godly, skilled, mature, wise teachers, older long-term teachers committed to God and their church. The church does need to rethink why it's educating. And folks, we're educating to form worshipers and lovers of God. Right now, we produce maybe more business people than we produce the other. And I'm not against business in any way, please. But instead of makers of money, lovers of God first. Our churches need to see the Great Commission and education as partners in the war for our souls. We can no longer only be a safe haven for the rising generation. Yes, it needs to be safe. But we will lose our young people if we take that approach. We must see ourselves as more. Our young people want to be a part of something bigger. We must see ourselves as resources for an incredibly broken world. It's going to get messy. We are developing soldiers in our schools in a cosmic battle in which God is winning, but He does depend on His church to carry that kingdom vision forward. We are not simply trying to raise compliant, nice Mennonites. We are trying to develop and form people, young people who love God and love men enough to get into the battle in this incredible cultural struggle we're in. Young people want to own their beliefs. They aren't out to get us or to create trouble. They just want belief that genuine struggle brings. They don't even care so much about stuff the way my generation and older maybe did. They just want to make a difference. We have got to reach that group. And so, I have a vision. I have a vision for our people, our Anabaptist people, to be a force that the darkness of this world has to reckon with. A battle against the spirit of the age, as Peter talked about it. A vision where godly, thoughtful lovers of God, worshipers of God, where people selflessly love each other, and so by our love will be known by everybody that they love God. I have a vision for our schools under and in partnership with the church, producing creative, energized young people who will carry the torch of biblical Christianity and practice in the midst of cataclysmic cultural change. Our people are poised to meet that. We can. I have vision for lovers of God and not of this world. I have visions of lovers of God, not America. I have visions of lovers of God, not lovers of money. Will our churches and schools together do the hard work of coming back to the vision of Jesus for all His people, for all His children? That of loving God with heart, soul, mind, and strength. Is anything left unturned there? If we cannot do this, if we cannot think beyond tomorrow's problems and lesson plans, if we do not have conversations about where we're at, the church will look quite different in 50 years. We're at a crossroads in many of our schools. Will our churches and schools together do the hard work of coming back to the vision of Jesus for His children? To love God with heart, soul, mind, and strength. The future of Anabaptism rests on this.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.